The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome to the podcast on Thursday, the 23rd of May, 2019. On the podcast today, I have James Draper, Chief Executive Officer of Bidstack, BIDS. And James talks about the new member of their team, their second agreement with Codemasters, and more. Plus, I also have David Price, CEO of Rockfire Resources, R-O-C-K, and David covers their recent news, including the option to acquire the Copper Dome Porphyry copper deposit in Queensland, Australia. Plus, I have Glenn Goodman, former ITV News business correspondent and now author of The Crypto Trader. And Glenn gives tips on what to look out for if you're new to crypto trading. Also, I have Chris Bailey, founder of FinancialOrbit.com, talking about Marks & Spencer, AJ Bell, Mitchells & Butler, Ibstock, Inchcape, and Hotel Chocolat. And as always, I have two lists for you, the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours, and the top five most liked RNSs too. By the way, you can see top 10 versions of these lists at voxmarkets.co.uk, where you'll see a host of other content right there. Oh, and by the way, if you use the Vox Markets app, which is absolutely free, you can get RNSs straight to your phone, prices, news. If you use that, and of course you get value from it, but it's free, like I say, then please, you know, pay back a bit of kind by giving us a review at the App Store. That would be much appreciated.
Vox Markets is an online community of investors that runs a free mobile and desktop platform that allows you to track news and updates about any UK-listed company, offering RNS push notifications, detailed charts, pricing data, and much more. Find out more at voxmarkets.co.uk/app.
And joining me on the podcast right now is James Draper, Chief Executive Officer of Bidstack, BIDS. James, thanks for joining me.
Absolute pleasure as always, Justin.
You've had two bits of significant news out in the last week or so, and we'll touch on those. I always like to do this. I think people see you, they sort of, some people are not investors, you know, they sort of half understand what you're doing, but they don't understand the significance of where you are and the potential upside here. But just give an overview. If someone's listening right now, I've only just, you know, heard of Bidstack. How would you describe the company to them?
So we work with game publishers large and small, and we sell exclusively, basically go to game publishers large and small, and we agree an exclusive multi-year arrangement for us to own the billboard and advertising opportunities that sit naturally within a gaming environment, and offer those spaces up to brands across the world based on who the demographic of the player is. So we sell that programmatically, or we can do it on a direct IO basis, but programmatic gives us scale.
Yeah, and quickly, someone's thrown a question at me saying, I mean, that is your main focus, in-game, native in-game, yes. Programmatic. But are you looking at other, because I know in your admission document you said there may be other types of ads as well you're looking at. Is that still the case?
So what we found, and I'll try not to be like a politician here, and I'll try and actually answer the question. So what we found since we first floated up, there's been an awful lot of inbound interest to us from these video game publishers, developers. It's all been to date, or very recently, it's all been very much inbound based. For mobile titles in particular, there are advertising opportunities outside of the pure native play, which is our differentiator. They would be reward videos. If you've got 10 lives, you run out, you watch a reward video for 30 seconds and you get your lives replenished and off you go again. Mm-hmm. It's almost like an opt-in thing. You don't have to watch it, but if you want to pick up the game again, you don't want to do any microtransactions, you watch an advert and off you go again. We found that there are opportunities for that advertising which have been offered up to us by our game developers and publishers who we are talking to and working with already. So what we're making sure is that we don't chuck away what is basically free revenue to us, which being obviously a public company, we've got exciting numbers to hit, etc. So it makes an awful lot of sense for us to be the de facto go-to media owner of all advertising opportunity that sits within a video game environment, whether that be natural or outside of it. So in short, yeah, there are additional advertising streams, revenue opportunities for us to go after outside of the pure native proposition. What we define obviously as native is somewhat different to some people in the advertising space. We would say it's the natural placements that sit within a game. But it's fair to say that we use the native proposition as our standout, our differentiator, but we can also deal with additional opportunity as well.
Yeah, yeah. I've seen that kind of reward thing as well. Blockchain's involved in that as well a bit. And you did mention blockchain when you were raising money. Does that tie in with that?
It can do. I mean, yes, there are many exciting blockchain opportunities ahead of us. Probably won't disclose those at the moment on this, because we know that certain people listen to this. But there are opportunities for us within it. We've got some talent within the Bidstat boat that maybe has not been fully shared yet. Some are consultants, some we'll be able to talk about in more detail soon, that give us that view into that market. That technology, the opportunity that sits within it. There are a number of very interesting people, you know, who are surrounded by the blockchain universe that we're talking to. One in particular I went to go and see over in San Francisco. I liked that particular individual very much in terms of what they've achieved to date. Like I said before, they were described in I think 2016 as the godfather of video games. They are extremely well connected, and they're a big advocate for things like blockchain. But it's fair to say it's kind of like a buzzword. It gets investors excited. You mentioned blockchain everywhere, but there's more interesting immediate opportunity that I'm focused on in day to day. With what we have here that's outside of the native proposition in certain ways, but as I mentioned before, it hopefully sort of tees you up for maybe the next question about E3, but I would say that there are a number of interesting and potentially industry-defining or redefining announcements that are going to come out over the next 4, 5, 6 weeks from the major players. So it's that which we're looking at, and we have an idea of what people are doing. We've heard from various different people what certain strategies are, who's going to be announcing what when. It's not in the public domain yet, but we have that knowledge in-house. So we have a fairly decent competitive advantage over anyone who might be looking to follow the breadcrumbs after Bidstack's trailblazing adventure. So it's without being too waffly, there are a number of exciting things outside of blockchain that we're looking at now.
Yeah. Well, let's get on to your main business, as it was. So you mentioned E3 there. Let's get straight on to that. So E3, what's it all about, and why specifically are you going there?
It's a big sort of show, and it's a weird event, really. In many ways, it's in certain ways it's scaled back over the last few years. It was very much everyone rock up together and do a big presentation. You'd have Microsoft turn up there, you'd have Sony go and announce all of the games they're going to be releasing in the fall of that coming year, and it'd be very much like a big reveal. What happened with GDC, when you've got Google Stadia, and it's fair to say that suggestions of what they might have been up to leaked in and around the industry before it was announced in March. The specifics were sort of disclosed, but prior to that, there was a fair understanding that Google had a severe interest in building a gaming platform off the back of YouTube. So Sony pulled out of E3, but Microsoft are going to do a big show and tell there. But it's fair to say that the conference center itself and the announcements are going to be interesting, but it's the people who are scattered around Los Angeles in the bars, etc., after the conference center is closed, where where most of the interesting conversations will occur, and it's flooded with a who's who of the gaming space that not necessarily go into the conference, but scattered around it. So we're taking a large portion of our UK team over to make sure that we are infiltrating every single opportunity that will present itself over the course of that show. It's fair to say that Microsoft have already made it quite clear they're going to announce at least more detail on the xCloud proposition. There's the interesting bit of information which I actually first saw from you, Justin, actually, when I came out of a meeting. I saw that you you don't know if the tie-up between Sony and Microsoft, which is, again, it's that you could imagine how that fast forwards over the next few years of how those two companies could potentially work together closer in terms of Sony going to build out a cloud gaming proposition off the back of Microsoft's technology. Microsoft are going to explain more about how their xCloud works, very similar to Stadia, but Google have obviously got YouTube, which is a huge competitive advantage. We know Amazon are up to bits and pieces as well. There are other people in that space that are doing some pretty interesting stuff. So it's going to be interesting to see the fallout from what Microsoft say. Maybe there might be some other potential competitors, those guys who might be a little bit mischievous and say things in and around that in and around the time Microsoft takes the stage. We'll see what happens. But it's very much worth us being there, as it is the big showcase PR event of the gaming circuit.
Yeah. So people are not aware. It's evolving gaming. It's going towards a streaming model. And how is that significant for BidStack, James?
Well, it's basically Spotifying the gaming market. Now it's fair to say that we have some ideas of the business models of some of the participants in that, which I won't talk about now. So I'll probably get shot if I did. So, but it's fair to say that if you look at the Spotify model, mm-hmm. And what that did to the music market, you can imagine in high fidelity gaming, that type of revenue model could be replicated. As such, the ways in which game publishers generate revenue outside of microtransactions, for example, our proposition is very useful to that. On top of that, if you were to look at Google Stadia's technology and what that opens up in terms of stapling superhero game streamer to what was traditionally a passive audience and making them potentially able to get involved with the experience, and BidStack being able to replace the advertising based on those people getting involved, that type of technology, not saying that we obviously have to RNS everything which we agree, right? So let's just say that type of technology and that type of opportunity plays completely into our proposition. It's why we were so excited when we were at GDC. It's definitely, it's fair to say that we don't want to fast forward 3, 4, 5 years and look back on this moment when we had some information which is very useful to us to understand who's we feel is going to win and who's going to get stung in this new model. Today, right now, everything's possible. We can become as big as we so wish to become if we capitalize on all the opportunities that are about to present themselves over the next 6, 12, 18 months. So it's going to change the industry forever, I believe. I can definitely see it doing to the high fidelity gaming market, to exactly what smartphones did to the casual gaming market, created a new space. It's going to make the influencers rich beyond belief. They're already doing pretty well, but it will make those type of people far, far richer due to the opportunity that they're going to be presented by this new technology. And it's probably fair to say that certain players into this market don't, and I'm talking about the cloud gaming services themselves, probably have positioned it slightly wrong. They're going to be surprised about what their technology is going to end up being used for. but it all is very beneficial towards us.
Mm-hmm. Let's go into some recent news. Two bits of news. So start at the start of the week. Lewis Sherlock as Vice President of Sales. Amazing track record, this guy, isn't he? I mean, how did you come about this? And also, people are asking a lot of times, and I've sort of summarised, but it's amazing how you're attracting this talent. And so, first of all, talk about Lewis, and then why are you managing to attract this talent?
My amazing charisma?
Yeah,
of course, yeah. No, joke aside, in short, this is a massively important hire for us. We had to get this person right. We scoured about 75 individuals, got down to six that we had a serious look at. What we loved about what Lewis brought to us, his experience, you can go onto his LinkedIn profile and have a sort of proper nosy over that. But he's got startup experience in terms of his AdaptTV background. He pretty much created the revenue model for that business, drove it all the way through to an exit, works well within a big corporation, became head of DSPs for Verizon Oath. His background in WPP is one of the founding pillars of Xaxis, which is an enormous player in the advertising space within WPP. He's set up his own P&L multiple times. He's very, very structured. If you saw his presentation he gave to myself, to Francesco and a few others here on the product side, he outlaid, I think, like a 40-page presentation on what he would do with us. It was anything from a 90-day plan to how we would stretch out over the next 12, 18 months. It was, I would say, and I'm not exaggerating, it was the most impressive BidStack presentation I've ever seen. And off the back of that, you know, we offered him the job right there and then. It was amazing. He's come in. He's almost, I would say, his mindset is like a very thorough product guy who happens to be very good at selling as well. He's very, very mechanical in the way he works, which is what we need for something which is net new like this. We can't have a bunch of Dell boys running around. It wouldn't work. We need articulate, methodical storytellers who can really explain what we've got today. And by building out what we're basically building out, an entirely new ad category. So if you were to fast forward 12, 18, 24 months, if we do what we say we can do, which, you know, we're pretty confident on, what we mean by building an ad category is that when you've got media planners sitting down, advertising media planners, building out a where to spend advertising budget, in-game native will be a new line item which will be considered for all campaigns going forward. It will be part of that discussion. Do we use in-game native? But at the moment, it's not been a recognised ad category, ad format at all. So it's not even part of the planning phase. So what we're having to do is methodically work through how to define what is an impression in a racing game compared to a football game, compared to a battle royale game, into an open world environment. What do we define as, what is viewability like? How is it? You look at on a web page, you're normally looking at 100% in view is when an advert's on in display for 2 seconds or more. But if you're playing a football game, it's different from when you're at a start grid of a racing game, for example, and you've got 5 seconds there before the lights go out or whatever it might be. It's, we're having to define precisely what the standards are of this new ad category. So when we're not pumping out loads of RNSs, it's because we've got our head down and actually defining what this is with all of our partners around us. And there's an awful lot of work for us to do internally between now and September. And when we get to September time, it's fair to say that a lot of the heavy lifting will have been achieved by that stage. You fast forward 12, 18 months, we should be on media plans all over the world. That's what we are aiming for.
Yeah, I sort of covered this. I didn't understand this until I sort of read that article in The Drum where you say, you know, work is being done to improve the verification and trackability of these kind of ads. Because, like you say, it's new, it's brand new. People have not done this before. And even though it seems like a hassle, because you're the guys doing it, you are trailblazing. And so, of course, you're the guys who are going to be the trusted people in this area. So at the moment, you've got ads, obviously, in Football Manager and all that stuff. How does that work then? I mean, how do you monetize that if you haven't got that tracking and all that stuff in there, like tracking pixels and all that?
At the moment, the way in which we're sort of working with Football Manager, we do a few types of deal structure for that particular real estate. Again, it can be anything from tenancy agreements, or what we class a tenancy is a set period of time and charge a very reasonable CPM, all the way through to, we are obviously hooked up to a couple of programmatic platforms already, DSP platforms already. So with those guys, it depends on what it is. Independent agencies who are more trusted, they have a closer relationship with their customers, the actual brands themselves, they are able to unlock spend far easier without all the things like the tracking pixels, the verification, the viewability, the set ad standards and things like this. It's they're far more flexible because they're smaller, the more dynamic. But the big holding groups, it's fair to say, for us to unlock the massive spends, those guys want as much of the buying side to be de-risked as possible. So what we've been working with is, you know, it's fair to say on record that Sports Interactive and Codemasters have been absolutely wonderful to us in terms of working very much almost like a JV, in terms of working out how to define viewability in that environment, but more to the point, the independent verification side, which is a very big technical hurdle which has not been done before, such as if you're dropping an independent tracking pixel into a game, that is very difficult to persuade a game studio that we're going to drop in a third party bit of software into each and every gamer's session, and we're not going to do anything which is going to harm the experience. Got to obviously inform what type of data we're pulling out, etc., etc. So it's a huge amount of trust, mm-hmm. And it's why I would say this. You know, it's great that there are a bunch of these smaller companies that are popping up now. Some making more noise than others. Some doing some great things. Some claiming to be doing some great things. We know from the work we're doing that we are absolutely out front. And very much defining what this market will be in the future. So it's a lot of work. It's very thorough, but it's fair to say between now and the end of the year, we've got two big milestone targets I've given out to the team that will be significant for us by the end of the year. So we've got two big targets we're working towards. There's micro targets that of maybe a list of 15 or so, but there's two big targets which everyone here is aware of that we've got to hit. So we're making sure that we are preparing ourselves to make sure that we get to both of those milestones, and we'll be able to talk about what they are at the end of the year. It'll be quite clear what they are when they get announced. It'll be quite clear what those two milestones are.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I suppose it helps. You've got, like we haven't mentioned yet, but you're now in the second title with Codemasters, like you say, a AAA rated game and publisher and all that stuff. So the fact that you are trusted in that realm and in that for that kind of company, you know, and all the people you've got around you now must help, you know, massively, mustn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. It's a. It's fair to say that Grid was. The original Grid on the Xbox 360 was one of my personal favourite games. So it's an absolute honour to be associated with such a fantastic series. I don't know if you've seen the preview videos that they put up of the gameplay over the last 24 hours, but yeah, it's fair to say there's a fair amount of advertising opportunity trackside in both the tracks they've shown, which is very much appreciated. There's an awful lot of clear, visible space there. It's working across multiple platforms. Codemasters have some big ambitions as well. We are very lucky to be working alongside them as they are executing on their very ambitious plans themselves. So it's an honour to be working with those guys. And it's a great and unique challenge as well to be able to try and define what a racing game ad impression is. It's one of the more complicated environments to define what that standard would look like in that world. And it's difficult to pick out a more famous motorsport studio that's been around for 30 years. They've done an incredible job with a number of titles they've released. Very talented individuals over there. Frank is an excellent CEO over there as well. And, you know, we've had a very enjoyable time working with him, their commercial guys, and their studio heads over there. It's a very useful client for us to have. And it's fair to say as well, I don't know if I've even mentioned this before, but Frank's background, he was doing in-game native advertising for Double Fusion over 10 years ago. So he very much understands what we are doing, but it's pre-programmatic. But Frank is a big advocate of us. So yeah, it's a great client for us. Great client, great games, fantastic space, multi-platform as well. And it's only the beginning of our relationship with those guys, and there are many more exciting things to come.
Yeah. Well, that challenge, like you say, there, it's a good thing, isn't it? Because it's a bit of a moat, you know, for other companies. You know, you are there, you are doing that challenge, and you like your conference, you're breaking the back of it. But like I said, that creates a massive challenge for other companies, especially who don't have the resources that you have.
Yeah, absolutely. It helps being a PLC as well. You know, there's good and bad sides about being a PLC, but the very much. The good element of it is it gives a certain amount of trust to people when you are rocking into a standard setting organization and you go, we want to do this, we want to define an ad category. If we'd just taken on a Series A and Series B, for example, being private, it probably would have been harder. And we know that we're the only guys talking to these bodies in the level of detail that we are. We're the only guys talking to these people. As such, there's a lot of noise out there, which is great. It's good, it's drawing attention to this sector, but there's a lot of noise out there. And it's fair to say that if you go down like an agency model of just doing hard-coded stuff, that's fine, that's wonderful, but it's not in the same league as what we're doing here, and in terms of the frictionless scalability, we're comfortable about where we sit within this ecosystem, and it's fair to say as well, which I won't go into too much detail on, but we had a very interesting conversation with some people over the last week that will define even greater opportunity for us going forward in terms of additional control for Bidstack. We want to be in more control of our overall destiny here. We've got a business which is very exciting, but we can get more control, and the industry is evolving at such a pace. I don't think many of the legacy players within the gaming space realize what's happening to the industry right now. Between now and the end of the year, it's going to be a massive seismic shift, and some of them are just too big to move fast. And we're at the right size, right space, right proposition. We want to go and maximize the commercial opportunity that sits in this space over the next 6-12 months and drive that home. So I think we're quite comfortable where we sit on the native proposition and other things outside of that.
Yeah. But in the meantime, you think there's plenty of news coming out between now and, I mean, when does Grid go live? Is it September 13th, isn't it, I think?
Yeah. Yep. There will be many interesting pieces that we will announce along the way. Very exciting 6-7 months in particular for us. I said there's two significant pieces that are targets internally that we would talk about openly if and when they get done. Maybe 15 more pieces that are internal metrics here, not necessarily RNSable, but things which we are working through internally. And we will obviously continue to expand the team. We will continue to get, as and when is appropriate, be able to start disclosing some of the things which are going on here. But it's, yeah, from an investor point of view, I think everyone should be quite excited about what we've achieved so far and where the industry is going to go. And what we will be able to disclose along the next 6 months should excite the long-term holders in particular.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, listen, James, you've featured in the top 10 most followed quite a lot on Vox recently, and I think after the last announcement yesterday, you were number one. But, you know, if people are not following the story as yet, and in fact, someone today said, I've just understood what's going on here. They saw a video of mine last night, they understood it. But for people not familiar, not understanding it, but now they're starting to understand what you're about, give them three quick reasons why they should hit that follow button on your page and add you to their watch list, please.
I would definitely say the size of the market, of the gaming market, it's exploding. Do some research into that. It's very exciting, and you'll see where we fit into that ecosystem. The time of year in particular to follow us right now with what's coming up with E3 next month, I would definitely say there's going to be some interesting announcements in and around that. And it's fair to say that we're not sitting on our hands, and there are a bunch of things that we should be able to disclose over the near to medium term, which should excite people who've got a holding with us.
Mm-hmm. And don't forget your strategy. You mentioned that. I quite like that. You mentioned the bottom of Lewis's release. To grow BidStack into the biggest media owner in the video game sector. Is that still your aim?
Of course. It's like we want to be undoubtedly seen amongst all advertising agencies and advertisers. All brand activation within the video game space should come through us. That is our main goal, and we need to protect our own destiny, more control. That is what we're all focusing on internally. So yes, we want to become the de facto biggest media owner in the game space 2021 end of. That's what we're all focused on, I feel anyway, towards getting to.
Marvellous, James, good to chat to you, and no doubt we'll be catching up in the not too distant future. Thanks, fella.
No worries, mate.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is David Price, Chief Executive Officer at Rockfire Resources. Rock is the ticker there. David, thanks for joining me.
Thanks very much, Justin. Lovely to be speaking with you.
Yeah, I don't know if I said that, but that's a cracking ticker, isn't it? Rock. Very easy to remember.
it was designed to be memorable.
Yeah, well, that's part of the battle. I mean, there's tickers that stick in my mind, and some that don't at all. And I think, what's that company? I can't remember that name. And so, yeah, but that's very good. So let's get into it. So, Rock is easy to remember. For people who are not familiar with the company, David, just give us a brief summary of what Rockfire Resources is all about, please.
Sure, Justin. Rockfire is a company that's very much focused on gold, copper exploration. But all of our projects at present are in Queensland, in Australia. And we've got a variety of projects in Queensland that range from early stage through to more advanced drilling. And importantly, we actually have very good range of geological environments that range from very deep porphyries to high-level epithermals. So we've got a great suite of projects in Queensland. And we've been exploring them systematically, and part of the strategy for Rockfire is to be able to explore these systematically, logically, and to develop them in time to become mines. So we are focused on advancing our projects in Queensland, and we're going through all those stages at the moment.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, before we get to today's news, which is the exercise of the option to acquire Copper Dome there, you've had lots of news out in the last few weeks and, in fact, months. So starting when we last chatted, after we last chatted, you did a field exploration update. You've had a double event surface anomaly, continues to expand. You've had Cardigan Dam returns broad, coherent gold anomaly. So if you could, take us through those, David, and you know the significance of these, please.
Sure, Justin. Look, we've been very busy. Our teams have been out constantly in the field. And as part of our assessment of each of our targets, what we do is the background work. A lot of the background, very boring work like soil sampling, mm-hmm. tends to get overlooked in the excitement of drilling, but it is essential work that needs to be done. So we're doing all of that background work in the lead up to drilling. So as far as double event is concerned, we did a soil sampling program to extend that project to the west, and it increased the overall strike of the double event project to 4.5 kilometres long with very high grade rock samples up to 58 grams per tonne gold, and the gold in soil, even extreme values, 3.86 grams per tonne gold in a soil sample. So very unusual to get those level of results, but obviously very pleasing for us and very encouraging for the prospectivity of the project. So double event is looking good with those soil samples and providing targets for us. Then we moved on to Cardigan Dam. The project there is within the Lighthouse tenement also. And we had great results from there. We had a soil sampling program that brought up to 0.2% gold, so it's not as high as the grams per tonne, but 0.2 grams per tonne gold. And really nice structures there. They look as though we've defined intersecting faults there. And, of course, intersecting faults with gold is always good, but the point of intersection is even better because very often you can get bonanza grades at those intersection points. So it looks as though that sampling program may have identified one of them. We're not quite sure yet, of course, because it's only soil sampling, but tremendous encouragement from Cardigan Dam. And then more recently we moved on to Copper Dome. And what we did originally earlier in the year is that we did a soil sampling program that took in the northern half of Copper Dome, and the more recent program covered the southern extension of that, and that is the second porphyry to the south. And we've been very encouraged by these recent results, which we announced yesterday. We're getting up 0.1% copper in the soils and 0.1 grams per tonne gold in the soils also. So reasonably high-grade gold, a reasonably high-grade copper in the soils. But importantly, it has extended the soil anomaly for another 500 metres towards the south. So looking a very attractive target there, which of course has led to today's announcement for the exercise of our option over Copper Dome.
Yeah, I was going to say, you say that, you know, soil sampling can be overlooked sometimes, but this is a regimented process you have to go through to get to the final result, and that leads us up to today's announcement, doesn't it? So now you're quite pleased, I suppose, overall, or more than pleased overall with the work you've been doing, and so you've exercised this option now. So what's next then, David?
Well, as far as the option exercise is concerned, we're now in the process of getting those shares issued to the vendor, and those shares equate to about £24,000 of value of shares. So it was a reasonably amicable deal between ourselves and the vendor, and it means that we can now move on to geophysics. Having done the geochemistry, and we're very pleased with those results, the next step is to back that up with evidence from geophysics. So we'll do our ground magnetics at Copper Dome, and then what we'll do is that we'll do some ground gradient or AIP, which is effectively going to find if there are any resistive or conductive bodies that might point towards accumulation of sulfide, effectively is what you're looking for. So we'll use these three-dimensional techniques to be able to have a look at these what's beneath the soil geochemistry, and they will then lead us into drilling targets. So our work doesn't stop here. It's just the beginning now that we've exercised that option. A number of people have said, why did it take us so long to exercise the option? We left it to the last day. But there's a very good strategy for that, and that is that as you, you provide your company with more time to look at this and actually wait until the exercise time, you actually find out if there are any skeletons that are going to come out of the closet at you. Those skeletons could be landowner issues. They could be native title issues. They could be access issues, any number of things that can spring out at you. So we gave ourselves the most amount of time possible to make sure that no skeletons were going to come out, and they didn't come out. It's a great project, and we're very, very happy with the project.
Yeah, well, exactly. Why not take, you know, as much time as you can? Because, you know, once you're committed, that's it, isn't it, really?
Absolutely. And a lot of companies short-circuit that process and find themselves in a bit of trouble.
Yeah, marvelous stuff. Cool. Okay, David, so if someone's listening right now and like the sound of what you're doing here but are not yet following the story, give them three quick reasons why they should hit that follow button on your page on Vox Markets and add you to their watch list, please.
Sure. Number one reason, we're looking at big projects. We are looking at building these into world-class deposits, these big, big porphyry coppers, which will incorporate an enormous amount of copper one day. We hope that's the aim, is to develop these big projects. The early signs for size are very good, and that's why we're progressing those projects. You've got number two, very good management. I say that in necessity more than anything. But look, we've got a good track record, and we do develop projects successfully. And we brought some new board members on, which are going to add to that skill set. And then thirdly, of course, the typical story, we're vastly undervalued at this stage. We're sitting at less than a penny. So we're still hoping that that's not going to stay there for very long, and we're working very hard to build that share value.
Yeah, marvellous stuff. Well, David, it's good to chat to you, and like I say, it's good to hear the story unfold, and no doubt we'll be catching up again in the not-too-distant future. Thank you very much.
That'll be great. Thanks, Justin. Bye.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Glenn Goodman, author of The Crypto Trader, of course, former business correspondent for ITV. Glenn, thanks for coming on the podcast again.
Always a pleasure. How
listen
are you doing?
Good, Dan. Listen to this. You can hear this. Hear that? That's a book in front of me. I've got a book here. It's in bright sort of purpley colours. It's got The Crypto Trader on the front. It's got Glenn Goodman and your handsome face right at the bottom left there. The good guys at Harriman House have sent me a copy of your book. And I have to admit, I haven't read it all. I've started reading it. And I agree with the guy who actually interacted with us on Twitter, saying this is a book for trading, not just crypto trading. It does steer the murky waters that sometimes can be murky waters of the crypto world. But it's just generally a good book for trading. And so can you explain why that is? Why did he say that, do you think?
Well, I've been trading for about 20 years, so obviously nearly all of that time was trading not cryptocurrencies, seeing as they haven't existed for that long. Yeah. People talk about cryptocurrencies having been around for 10 years, but frankly, nearly all of that time, it was just Bitcoin on its own with a few other dodgy coins lying about. It's only really the last 2 or 3 years that lots and lots of other credible cryptocurrencies have come about. So yeah, I've got a long history trading first stocks and shares and then futures of all kinds, you know, commodities and forex and treasury bonds and everything you care to mention. So yeah, most of the wisdom, as I'd like to think of it, in my book is based around trading any type of instrument, though obviously I apply it specifically to cryptocurrencies in certain parts of the book and talk about how the logistics of how you go about getting on certain exchanges that are safer than others and trading cryptocurrencies in a relatively safe way. But the actual trading advice itself, the strategy, the techniques are more or less applicable for any instrument.
It's like risk management, I suppose, isn't it?
Is that, lots of that.
And let me give you the full title here. It says, The Crypto Trader, How Anyone Can Make Money Trading Bitcoin and Other Cryptocurrencies. So do you stick to, I mean, how many cryptocurrencies do you trade? Because I know some people tend to stick to the main ones like Ethereum and Bitcoin, but how many do you actually trade? Is there some you just trust? I know some people, like with pairs and FX pairs, they like, you know, they get used to and familiar with a certain pair. What's your strategy? Do you have lots you trade, or do you stick to a couple or a handful or what?
There are the big ones that everybody's heard of. Well, everyone's heard of Bitcoin, obviously. And then there are a few just below that, like Ethereum, you might have heard of, Litecoin, people might have heard of, and a few others. But it's a tricky one, because when you're first getting into it, as with any kind of trading, it probably makes sense to cut your teeth on the biggest ones because they trade in a slightly less volatile way than some of the tiddlers. But, you know, as many of your listeners will know, once you get into the smaller issues and the kind of up-and-coming ones, then that's where you can sometimes find some real bargains that just absolutely shoot off to the moon in crypto parlance. And so, no, I don't just limit myself to the biggest ones at all. I've made some large profits on very small ones. I give a few examples in my book.
Yeah, do you know what? I suppose it's a bit like when I first started investing, I started with the companies I heard about, like, you know, BT's or Tesco's or Marks and Spencer's and all that stuff, the blue chip FTSE 100 companies. And then you realise, hang on, there's a lot more risk down the lower end of the market, but a lot more potential reward as well. But after a while of trading it or investing it, for me now, I have quality filters that I look for in every small cap company. But I stick to small caps or micro caps because I know your potential, you know, you can multi-bag on those. And you can't do that with Marks and Spencer's or Tesco's or whatever. And so is that the case? So you've gone down in market size in the cryptocurrencies? Is that the case?
Yeah, I have gone down in market size, and I still also trade some of the big issues as well, because Bitcoin, for example, has had a tremendous run over the past few months. It's more than doubled in price. So it's not quite equivalent to Tesco's and Marks and Spencer's. It's a lot more exciting than either of those two, even though it's the biggest issue around. But some of the smaller ones have the potential sometimes to double and then double again and double again and double again. So I do try and keep my eye on those, because those are where the really, really big profits are to be made. Though, of course, it's all relative, because even with Bitcoin, you can make really big profits. It's just that with the others, you can make really, really big profits. Yeah. And obviously, I don't want to kind of imply that it's all one way, because I was, I always like to tout my claim to fame, which is I was one of the few people to kind of call the top of the market at the end of 2017 and warn my followers and say, this is getting really dodgy now. There are signs of the market beginning to crash. It's time to start thinking about getting out. What was really interesting, actually, is that retail traders, and it's frustrating to me, retail traders very often get in towards the end of a boom and just don't get the profits. They buy at the top and then they wait and then they panic and they sell right at the bottom of a crash. And I was, you know, doing my best to warn everybody, you know, things are getting feverish now, get out. But, you know, I don't know how many people heeded my warnings. All I can tell you is that in March last year, so just over a year ago, I was speaking at conferences which had thousands of people attending about cryptocurrency trading. Mm-hmm. I remember speaking to an audience in front of all these thousands of people, all staring rapt. They all want to know the secrets. And all I could tell them was, you've missed it. The market's crashed.
Now, they don't want to hear
really
that, do they?
Sorry. Yeah. They don't want to hear it. And what's more, they deny it. You know, there's that denial phase. Lots of people in the questions afterwards, they're saying, okay, so it's in a bit of a rut right now. It's, you know, it's it had a correction. Like, you know, people like to look at it that way. It's had a correction, a healthy correction. And in a month or two, it'll be back on the rise, do you think, Mr. Goodman? And I'd say, no, I'm afraid I don't think that, because that's not how market crashes work. They take absolutely ages to play out. As it was, we've actually had a relatively short one in cryptocurrencies. It only lasted, what, a year and a half before the new upswing began, which is short compared to stock markets. But what's interesting, of course, is that even though the price of Bitcoin has already doubled, the level of interest from retail traders is far, far lower than it was in March last year while the market was in the middle of a crash.
Do you know what? It's unbelievable. I often, you know, I tweet out sort of macro stuff sometimes as well that I think affects, you know, investors. And a lot on AIM, there's a lot of resource companies. You know, they're into, for example, electric vehicle. They're miners. They're explorers and miners, or mainly explorers in the resource sector, who are exploring for like maybe copper or lithium. And China is, you know, a massive. I mean, China consume half the world's commodities. So they're very linked to the way China's, you know, economy is working. And if it's slowing down, then that's not good for sentiment or for the price of commodities. And often if I see, you know, some stats about China coming out that's quite bad, and I'll tweet it, I get no reaction whatsoever. Now, if I tweet something bullish, that's not true, I'll get a lot more people liking it. Because people do not want to know. It's like, oh, if I can't make money off this, I don't want to know. And I think it's good to have that kind of, you know, realism and truth behind everything. But it's like, you know, it's the old adage, isn't it? Buy low, sell high is the oldest adage of the stock market. But it's harder than people think, because when things are low, people are just running. There's people running scared, so they're not buying. You know, it's when everything's high, and like you say, you go into those conferences where thousands of people are frenzied and frenetic, and they all think they can make lots of money. That's the top, pretty much. That's when everyone's bought in. You know?
Yeah, exactly. You look around the room at all the other kind of novice traders who are there while the market is falling, and you've got to, you know, if I were one of those people, I would be asking myself, hang on, am I the smart money in the room? Am I really?
Yeah.
You've got to think to yourself, no, I'm surrounded by a lot of other people like me. We're all new to it, and the market has been booming for years and has already gone parabolic. I don't think I'm the smart money.
Yeah, so at the moment, give us what are you looking at the moment that maybe you cite something, and this could be setting up for a good trade? Is there anything you've got your eye on, or at the moment are you stepping back? What's your thoughts at the moment?
Yeah, this, you know, as you catch me at this particular point in time this week, I am more feeling about possibly stepping back, but only possibly, because you see, what's happened, as I said, is Bitcoin has doubled over the past couple of months. It's had an unbelievable run, and in fact, its price has gone parabolic. It's just risen faster and faster and faster. And so people who got in early, and there aren't many of them, I'm proud to say I'm one of them, people who sort of bought into the beginning of this new trend, are starting to think, well, you know, how much further can it really go? But then, of course, it can go further. Like, as we know, as Keen said famously, markets can remain irrational longer than you can stay solvent. Mm-hmm. So just because it's doubled doesn't mean it's not going to double again. So I guess if I was starting out right now, I wouldn't necessarily be thinking, right, I'm going to buy Bitcoin today after it's gone parabolic and it's already doubled in price. Yeah. But that doesn't necessarily mean I'm going to sell the holdings that I've got. I'm in a kind of wait and see pattern at the moment. I'm waiting to see whether this is the end of it or whether it's got more legs and can go further, because I'm the kind of trader who likes to hang on. I'm a trend follower, basically. So I like to buy in a little bit late into the beginning of a trend. I miss the bottom eighth, as Jesse Livermore, the legendary trader, used to say, the bottom eighth and the top eighth are the most expensive eighths in trading. So I'll miss the bottom eighth, you know, see that the trend is just about established, then buy in, wait until the end, wait until the trend bends right at the very end, and you see those warning signs. They're always very clear. The trend is bending, and then it's time to get out just after the top.
Do you know what? That's very true, that about it, you know, the market doesn't just drop or fall off a cliff. And if you know a bit about charts and technicals, you can see it happening, can't you? You see, there's certain signals. For example, I look at momentum and the relative strength index, and you see a top pattern or double top or a lower high, and the strength coming down. And it does give you fair warning quite often, doesn't it? But it's whether you take that warning on board, you know?
Exactly. I mean, you know, if you were if you, Justin, were into Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies, well, you could do it now. Go and look at the chart from the end of 2017, and you'll see the signs just like I saw the signs. And, you know, I was considered by some of my followers going, how do you know? You're like a soothsayer. How do you know that it's crashing? And it's just because, you know, I've been trading for so long and I know what those charts look like. And like you say, it often takes a while to kind of play out, which is why, you know, we talked in your previous episode where you featured me, I think, about my experiences in 2008 as the market was crashing and I went short and I turned £3,000 into £100,000 in short order. But again, I wasn't a genius. The market had been slowly turning from bullish to bearish over the course of about a year since Northern Rock had crashed and everybody was queuing outside it the year before. So there was ample warning for anybody who actually looked at the chart and just believed the evidence of their own eyes. But we're more inclined as human beings to believe people like the bankers who would come on TV and say, oh no, everything's fine, this is just a temporary blip, this subprime thing is nothing to worry about. But the fact is, the chart was telling us that things were slowly turning around. There was a mountain forming, the peak of a mountain on that chart.
Yeah. Right, Glenn, what I'm going to do is I want to get you on regularly, because there may be people listening to this who, you know, I mean, AIM, you know, the alternative investment market, which is small caps, quite risky, has a lot of affiliation, you know, similarities to crypto, because it's quite risky and it's a bit of like the wild, wild west. You've got your book out there to try and help people steer these, you know, sort of stormy waters. So what I want to do is say, maybe come on, whatever you come on a regular basis, I want you to give one tip if people are starting off. And of course, the main tip is to get your book. I understand that. In fact, you've got a book signing coming up soon.
It's the official book launch, yeah. And everybody listening is invited. If you're anywhere around London on the 28th of May, I'd love to see you and come and meet you, or you come and meet me rather in person. It's in the Old Street tech area. I'll do a tweet about it and pin it to the top of my feed so that you can see where to come. You just need to register on Eventbrite. Come along, it's free. We'll have drinks and nibbles and stuff, and I'll do a little talk about how anybody can, well, actually, the title of the talk is "Can anyone make money trading cryptocurrencies?" Spoiler: the answer is yes, they can.
Okay, cool. And that's at Glenn Goodman. So, what I want is a tip—a very simple tip. If someone's just starting off, so and it can be linked to the book or chapters in the book if you want. But so, if someone now is listening, they say, "Oh, what might I go at crypto?" So, what's the first thing you'd say to them? And of course, buy the book is a given. But so, this is tip two, maybe. What would they do? A very basic person now, not a basic person, but a person who's not had a lot of knowledge in crypto. Where would they start? What's the first thing you'd say to do?
Okay, well, as a British person, we're all lucky because spread betting exists in Britain, and it allows us to trade without any tax implications. Though, of course, that doesn't worry a lot of your listeners because you're trading AIM shares, which don't have any tax implications either. But for cryptocurrency, there are, of course, tax implications. If you go above the capital gains tax threshold, they're taxed like shares. And so spread betting is quite a good way to avoid that if you think that your profits are going to be quite large. All the usual spread betting operators, you know, the biggest ones in the country, I won't name them, but we all know who they are. They offer a handful of the top cryptocurrencies. The only problem with them is the spreads. The spreads are quite large compared to the unregulated or lightly regulated cryptocurrency exchanges that I talk about in my book and on my website, which is just glenngoodman.com. Those places you will get much tighter spreads, though there is, of course, a small risk, because if one of these companies goes bust, you're not necessarily covered by, in fact, you're definitely not covered by the FCA rules, which means you won't get given £50,000 of your losses back if the company went bust. So there's a certain degree of risk of dealing with any company that isn't properly regulated just in case they go bust. But the ones that I talk about and the ones that I use have so far not encountered any serious problems, and I mitigate my risk by trading across a number of different platforms so that I never have much money on any one particular platform.
Marvellous stuff. And you can interact with Greg there on his Twitter account if you want to ask him questions. And buy the book first. And I think it's a good start. Glenn, thanks very much, fella. Hopefully we get you on a regular basis to help people if they want to start trading in crypto. You know, rather than just jump in like some people have and been burned, at least you can guide them, you know, towards...
Yeah, you've got to do it gently.
Yeah, exactly, towards a profitable trading career. Glenn, thanks for that, and hopefully we'll catch up very soon.
Yeah, look forward to it.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Chris Bailey, founder of FinancialOrbit.com. You all right, Chris?
Very good, thanks.
Are you off out to vote today?
Well, I haven't yet, but yes, I will be exercising my pan-European Parliament sort of democratic rights and whatever else. Not going to share who I'm going to vote for, but I'm not going to spoil the ballot. I think it's important to vote and give it a go. So I will be doing that at some point before 10 o'clock on Thursday evening.
Yeah, I don't think European elections have ever had so much interest, ever, have they? It's like, well, wow.
I'm not sure that the turnout's going to be absolutely massive, but I think you're right. I think there's going to be, let's call it a skewed turnout, but there you go. It's good. People should be fired up and excited. I use that word in a broad sense. They should be motivated and thoughtful about these things. So
yeah, but
that's good.
What's one of the positives of Brexit, if there is one, is that it's really got people engaged in politics a bit. I mean, maybe for the wrong reasons, but I did say this a while back. I said, hopefully hopefully what will come of this will we get a lot more younger people getting into politics who, you know, have the right sort of motivation. They're not just straight out of university with no job. You know, they'll think, okay, listen, I want to do something with my life and I want to get involved in politics. And but they see the leaders we have at the moment. Because at the moment, I just think this is a sort of proxy vote or proxy referendum almost, rerun, and people tend to be voting now for anyone apart from Labour and Conservative. So at least there's a bit of passion there, which I quite like, because what you don't want is complete apathy when it comes to voting, because you want people to express what they believe in. So I quite like that. It's had if anything, that's the only positive I can see from this farce that Brexit has become. But
I completely agree. Look, the biggest problem this country, and actually pretty much any in quotes developed market country, has is, as you say, Justin, apathy. Yeah. Or the fact that people are satisfied, be it on politics, be it on economics, be it on entrepreneurism. You've got to push. And if the government that inspires people to push in their personal life, in their political interaction life, in their economic lives, that's the one that creates a successful economy and country, in my opinion. So that's what we've got to try and get. And yeah, if people get fired up, that's good. Now channel this into something which is productive and useful and value add, whatever that might be. But better to be trying than not.
Yeah, let's look at the economy here. A couple of retail stories of late. Jamie's restaurants, I've never had anyone give any good feedback on, really, which is very odd, because he seems to have stood for quality local produce, but his restaurants didn't for some reason. No. But also another store, the sort of the high street, Marks and Spencer. I did see something that they may be coming out of the FTSE 100 because the stock price has gone down.
M&S is a complex one. I mean, Jamie's Italian, whatever. I think I went once. I don't have any particularly strong views on it. But, you know, the trouble is, we'll come on to that in a second with Mitchells and Butler, in terms of certainly the supply of restaurants going down, which I think for those left standing is good. But M&S, the big thing is the turnaround continues. We know it's a tough one. How many turnarounds have they had over the last decade or two? Yeah. But this one, they do seem to mean it, in the sense that they've actually done some tangible things.
They didn't before.
Well, before they kind of fiddled around and reshuffled the deck chairs on the storefront or whatever. But this time at least they've struck this deal with Ocado on food, and that's a proper tangible thing. And you think about the impact of that, they've announced this money raising, which obviously is the thing shareholders are going to have to decide on in the very near term, and that's one reason why the shares are under a bit of pressure. Okay, they announced it before, but now kind of you've got the terms and they're raising money at 180p odd, etc. So shareholders have got to decide on that. But, for me, the fact that they're linking up with Ocado, they're embracing digital and online delivery much more aggressively is a good thing. At least they're trying. Whether it works or not, it's another story. Mm. On the retail side, on the sort of non-food retail side, they are, materially cutting stores and trying, obviously, to switch online. And, again, that differentiates this turnaround approach, I would suggest, with other ones where they've seen the trends, but it's kind of been a bit more small scale. So they're giving it a good old go. Will it fall out of FTSE 100? I don't know. That obviously depends on other shares. My observation would be if they raise money, then perversely that can increase the market cap for obvious reasons. You've got more shares in issue, and even if you adjust for a lower share price. So that may actually, mean that it doesn't fall out of the FTSE 100. But, let's not forget, many of my best investments have come because companies have fallen out of the FTSE 100, because the tracker funds sell and related. M&S is in a longer-term turnaround sort of situation. It's a different old beast. But, don't sort of correlate being in the FTSE as being the reason for a success. It isn't. Ultimately, of course, good companies, the share prices rise and they are in the FTSE or the 250 or whatever. But my view would be on M&S. I do have a very small holding in M&S. And my view would be, I'm going to back the rights issue and I'm going to give them a chance, because actually I quite like Archie Norman, the chairman. I think the CEO came across and CFO came across quite well in the numbers on Wednesday. And ultimately, I think they're giving it a good old go, and it's the right thing to do, because ultimately you've got to drag the company into the 21st century, online, digital, full-on convenience, but also clearly mainstream stores as well. And you never know, it might just work.
Yeah, talking about funds buying in and buying out to rebalance for indexes and all this stuff, I was chatting, in fact, I know we were going to talk about AJ Bell. It's done very well, hasn't it, since it's come to the market? It's flown. Well, what's it like at the moment?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, you know, we've talked in recent weeks about things like Aston Martin, which has been an absolute shocker. You know, something obviously you and I know nothing about, just in terms of Aston Martin poncing around in sports cars. But, you know, that share's been a shocker since IPO. And obviously in the wider markets, you've had all this stuff about Uber, obviously had a pretty shabby open on the US market, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, AJ Bell, you know, wealth manager, owner of a variety of financial publications, all sorts of interesting angles, has done remarkably well. I think they IPO'd, was it just before Christmas, wasn't it, last year? And they've absolutely romped up year to date. Numbers came out today, the inaugural numbers, very important always in your inaugural numbers as a listed public company that you kind of at least hit expectations. They appear to have done that. So they've done extremely well, taking assets in and profits and revenues going up. So, you know, ticking all the boxes, you can debate, you know, there's a bigger debate about the valuation of the company, whether it's gone a bit too far. But all you can say is that was a much more fluid and sensible and well-received IPO than some of the other ones we could mention.
Well, do you know
so
what?
Good for them.
It's a theory I was discussing, right? Now, when they listed... The shares are very tightly held, and not a lot was on offer at the listings. Of course, that varies, doesn't it, how much percentage of the actual company they float. And if a small amount is listed, then first of all, it creates a lot of demand. But the share price started rising, and apparently it got into the 250. Now, you've got all these tracker funds that cover that need to buy stock, you know, and they can't get the stock. If there's a low free float around, it's going to obviously push demand up even further. And that's the theory, apparently. But obviously, the financials are very good. They hit expectations, and it's a good, well-run company. But there wasn't a lot of free float about. So, you know, this doing well anyway. People say this is going to do very well, this company. So the positive sentiment and the low free float and the fact they went into the FTSE 250 created a massive demand for the shares. And that's why they IPO'd, what... I think it was 160, and now they're
that's
£4
right.
over £4.
That's right.
So, you know, you've got that pressure, buying pressure, plus, you know, combined with low free flow and good sentiment surrounding the stock. Those combinations of things. So I was thinking, okay, what I'm going to look at now is look at family businesses have done very well. They're going to IPO where the family still hold a big chunk, but they are floating a little bit. And it's on the edge of an index, you know, sort of coverage. So that, you know, I mean, if you put that through a filter, Chris, and find companies like that, IPOing, all right, small free float, maybe a family business, then you could be onto something there because you get a lot of pressure, buying pressure, you know?
Yes, you could be. And the obvious pushback would be that's absolutely fine when capital markets are open and things are exciting and things appear to be moving in the right direction. Of course, the consequence of that, and you know, I think this has some applicability to AJ Bell, is that obviously the valuation gets pushed up. And it's when that gets pushed up to levels that ultimately are not sustainable. And you can get, you know, squeezes can go both ways. And suddenly a share that squeezes up rapidly can obviously reverse the other way. And, you know, I think back to much earlier on in my investment career, back to the sort of the dot-com excitements of 1999-2000 with Vodafone, you know, that well-known stock. I remember Vodafone, for similar reasons, it was over 10% of the FTSE. Investors had to have it. It was a massive part of index tracking exposure. People were just, you know, buying it hand over fist. It pushed up to over £4, and then obviously the decline started as clearly that they came under pressure in terms of lots of broader issues in the market. So, you know, I would always say it's good when it's going up, but when it starts to turn, then it can get quite bloody. So be cautious of that, and remember to jump off if things start going a bit crazy or trends start to reverse.
Yeah, moral stuff. Okay, what are the companies reported, Chris?
So, yeah, we got Mitchells & Butler, which is obviously the pubs and restaurant group, you know, quite well known in sort of Middle England, I guess, and the broader UK. Solid set of numbers. I was particularly struck by the fact that they punched up some numbers compared to their peers in the broader pub and casual sort of pub restaurant sort of business. And they all looked pretty good. And the numbers were all seemed to move in the right direction. The net debt level was going down. They said, you know, with reference back to things like Jamie's Italian restaurants and whatever else, that the supply of restaurants is clearly going down. That obviously has a positive impact for continuing players, assuming, you know, broadly stable demand conditions. solutions. And what struck me as there were still challenges out there, a bit of inflation, higher wages, obviously the broader omnipresent Brexit uncertainty, however that impacts our spending and all of that stuff. But actually profits were slightly up, debt was down, the shares have bounced today. And, you know, for me, am I a holder? Am I particularly excited about the stock? Not particularly, but I see it as a bellwether of sort of at-the-margin consumer expenditure propensity. And I think what they're saying is there is a real economy still there despite all the political angst and everything else. Mitchelson Butler seem to be doing all right in that. If you look at the share, put it on like a three-year chart, you can see it much better. 240 pence, that's absolutely amazing. Every time they kick around 240 pence, a bit of support kicks in at around about those levels. It's a little bit above that with today's bounce, but that's a level to remember, I would suggest, when, you know, headlines are excitable about the UK economy and politics and whatever else. So one to be watching.
Yeah, wow, got a massive spike today on that. I don't know if that's right. Sometimes on charts it doesn't show right, but it shows that it's gone from it opened at 249 or something, but it's gone up to, what's the high there? 267, it's come back down.
Yeah, that's right, that's right, that's right. Yeah, no, it was, I think, again, it's people were surprised by the fact they said, look, actually, there's been a decent bounce back. And, again, as I said, you know, a little bit of easy comps, a little bit of the weather being better, you know, weather's been all right, mm-hmm. sort of year to date or over recent months. So you put all of that together and it surprised a few people and squeezed the share up a bit. But, you know, that was a good one, I thought, today.
Marvellous. Anything else, Chris?
So a couple of other quick ones. A couple of companies beginning with I. Ibstock, a brick manufacturer, mm-hmm. A company I like, a company I own, for full disclosure. AGM statement today saying all the right things. You know, I've been very, very cautious on house builders. You know, that's an area I don't like at the moment. But it's not because there's actually a shortage of houses being required in the country. In fact, the opposite. I think the problem with the house builders is their margins are going to be under pressure and a lot of their profits are linked with government policy and government support mechanisms. By contrast, bricks are in shortage in the UK. We're still a net importer of bricks, unbelievably. And my feeling is the brick companies, there's only a few of them listed on the US, on the UK market, are in good stead and in a good position. Ibstock's one of the biggest in the UK, a solid name, I think, and saying all the right things in terms of higher prices, more capacity coming on and stuff like that, offsetting any sort of input cost issues that they've got. So I think Ibstock's a very solid name, quite yieldy, and I see value up to certainly somewhere nearer £3. So in the 240s today, I am still a at the very least a strong holder. So that was a good set of numbers from them, or comments from them.
You know what, bricks are funny. I mean, I just thinking in my head, I was thinking like, what's the guy with the who died a few years back with the tickle sticks? Ken Dodd. You know, he made up, was it a marmalade mine or something like that? Or a brick mine? Bricks, why can't we produce enough bricks? Where do they come from? How do they work? Well, I mean, is it just I imagine an underground mine just full of bricks, you know? So.
Well, you need obviously the raw materials. And, you know, there's certain parts of the country in terms of the clays and other key ingredients are well replete. You know, Ibstock, for example, is centred on Rutland, Leicestershire, round there. Many of their plants are in that area. And, you know, where they have those proximity to those, some of those raw materials and other issues and other factors they need. So, you know, it's not as if we haven't got the raw materials. It's just that it's like anything. In order to justify a plant and everything else and all of the sort of the kilns and the other inputs you need, you know, you need to have a medium-term view. Mm-hmm. And what's happened is there was a lack of capex in the industry for many, many years. And it was just easy. Let's just import them in from France, let's just import them in from somewhere else. Mm. And of course that's created a dependency but also an opportunity as well, particularly with the pound falling, foreign bricks becoming more expensive, etc. So Ibstock and others are now investing back in. I think Ibstock, one of the first to actually increase productive capability for many, many years in the UK. So, you know, it's all to do with investments and longer term trends and insightful management teams. And I think Ibstock, among some of the other ones at the top of this sector, actually there's a little enlightened group, let's put it that way, who I think are going to add value for shareholders over time.
Yeah, because it can't be cheap to import, because the transport, the bricks, they're heavy things, aren't they? You know?
This is it. You know, it's not like something which is very light. It's heavy and it's bulky, and it's, as I say, with the pound going down, if economics come more in favour of the domestic manufacturers. So okay. There you go. One to have a look at. Another quick one, beginning with I, Inchcape. Now, this is interesting. This is the complete reverse. You know, we've just argued about how the UK, something UK-centric could be interesting. Inchcape, you would know them as a retail auto distributor and retailer. They make most of their profits overseas. And today's statement is a classic. We all know the auto market's under pressure. We see it locally, etc. Inchcape haven't dodged it. They've said, look, the UK and the Australian auto retail market were tough for them. They did all right, but they were tough. But by contrast, Asia was absolutely going gangbusters. Now, that was absolutely fantastic. And this company, of course, makes most of its money in places like Asia. So, you know, again, it's interesting. It's a FTSE 250 name. It's one listed on the London market. But actually, when you look under the hood, excuse the pun, most of their profits are outside of the UK. So one where I think the share bounced today because people suddenly remembered, oh yeah, you know, they actually make most of their, you know, this is not sort of a UK-centered auto distributor and retailer. This actually has a bit of the UK, but actually lots of things like Asia, which actually is still quite interesting. So
I've been hearing that Asia's, you know, is suffering in the car market. So the sales in China especially are down for like consecutive quarters. So unlike before, so I don't know. How are they doing this?
Yes, well, they are, as with most, how can I put it, British colonial companies, they're much more active in other parts of Asia, for example, Malaysia, other parts of the British. Think about it a bit like something like the Pru, who obviously do have exposure to China, but in order to get China, you've had to negotiate special links and contracts, and it's all come a bit later. It was far easier to focus on Hong Kong and then push out to Singapore and Malaysia and the Philippines and places like that. And so this is a slightly broader play on, I would say, Pan-Asia, where, of course, you've still got sort of quite beguiling trends in terms of the growth of the middle class. And obviously, you know, you think about kind of the way transportation matures, you go from walking to the bicycle to the motorbike, and then you get the car. And so for a second-hand car retailer, or obviously one that sells new cars as well, that can be an exciting market, particularly when you've got great distribution. And these guys have been there for a while, and that's obviously what you build up. But you're right, Justin, the Chinese car market's under pressure, but let's not forget, in the 10 or 15 years before that, it absolutely exploded. You know, you've seen the pictures of Beijing 20 years ago and Beijing now. It's just night and day.
Yeah, absolutely. I know Jaguar Land Rover cited, you know, that issue, didn't they? In Chinese market is slowing down, and that was why they were having issues, amongst other things. Cool. Anything else, Chris, or is that it?
Final one has got to be Hotel Chocolat, just a quickie here. Yeah. We've all probably been to the shop. We may have consumed the products. I did note today they've got a capital markets day. Today, you know, a meeting with institutional analysts and people interested in the company. I mean, that's quite interesting in itself. I love the line, though, that they said that there'd be a product tasting at the end of it, which that has to be a way to get the numbers up in terms of attending such an event.
Yeah.
So I'm going to leave now and go to the product tasting.
Yeah, I just think a lot of people just probably turn up a bit late. Just let's get to the end just when they get the chocolate out. Do you know what was quite odd? I've been writing down these companies, you know, just so I can write them in the blog afterwards. And any company that ends with B and a bracket, it kept reverting by default to a smiley face with sunglasses on. And I thought, is that like some kind of tip to buy the stock? So AJ Bell, Mitchells and Butler, I couldn't write a B and then the bracket. All I get was a little icon with a smiley face and sunglasses. So I don't know if that's a, you know, sort of undercover sort of tip for me or something, you know, but very interesting that. But there we are.
There you go. There you go. The investment gods move in mysterious ways.
Yeah, I mean, that was the most random bit of, you know, sort of research on which to base your investment decisions. Lovely, Chris. Thanks for that. Have a nice weekend and bank holiday, and we'll speak next week.
Sounds plan. See you soon.
Okay, it's time for the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours. They are at five. Metro Bank, having a bit of a bounce last few days. I got into that a bit early. I don't know why I bother with punts. Unless I'm really committed, I don't really do the research and I just rush in. It's pointless. Pointless. I'm an investor, not a trader. Justin, remember that. So that's Metro, MTRO, up 5% a day. At four, Live Company Group. On the podcast yesterday, David Ciclatera, good business they've got there, and they're expanding into merchandising and licensing of that. LVCG, up 5%, pretty much 65 pence up yesterday as well. Doing very well. At three, Block Energy, BLOE, down 7.7% to 12.6 pence. They raise a chunk of money there. So a lot of people like that. A lot of people obviously have confidence in them. Paul's a good fella. Could do well. In this environment, it's not easy to raise money in this environment for oil and gas and resource companies. And so to raise 12 million, which is pretty much half their valuation, it's quite good, actually. Quite impressive. At two, Eve Sleep, EVE. I know people are talking about this. I think it's a bit of a trade room. I don't know. People be criticising it, deramping it, ramping it, deramping it. I don't know what's going on, but I did have a look, but it's in retail. It's not my thing. And at one, Bushveld Minerals, BMN is the ticker there. And let's go to the top five most liked RNSs. They are 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. At five, Bushveld Minerals. Final results for the year ended 31st December. At four, Sirius Minerals. Notification of major holdings. At three, 88 Energy, Alaska Projects Update. At two, Kalahari Metals Limited, Exploration Update. And number one is Big Dish. New locations on Big Dish. You can see the article on Vox Markets at voxmarkets.co.uk, and hopefully catching up with Aidan, the founder of Big Dish, very soon. That's it for the podcast. Thanks for listening. Muchos apreciados.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn. But hurry, these offers won't last forever. Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.